After last night's great dinner, everyone knows that Ken Cribb is the president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. Prior to joining ISI, Ken served in the Reagan administration at the White House and at the Department of Justice. Ken is also president of the Collegiate Network of College Newspapers and the Council for National Policy and a counselor to the Federalist Society. Ken served as president of the Philadelphia Society in the 1990s.
Yes.
Ken.
More precisely, I served between the two terms of Leonard Ligia. So in that sense, I was Benjamin Harrison to his Grover Cleveland. I think the analogy does not end there, although I will say it does end at the point that Benjamin Harrison had more hair on his chin than I have on my person. Oh, me. Now, instead of looking forward as enjoined, I will be looking backward, which proves that even an obsessive anti-communist can be a reactionary. I want to talk about the apparently contradictory presuppositions of the modern conservative movement and what it might mean for going forward. Apparently, Alfred North Whitehead had given a talk about the presuppositions upon which the world rests. And this man came up, true story, man came up to him after the speech and says, "You don't know what you're talking about. The world rests upon a great turtle." And Whitehead says, "Ah, but what does that turtle rest upon?" And the man says, "I'm way ahead of you, Whitehead. His turtle's all the way down." So my remarks might be called the warring turtles of conservatism. The Philadelphia Society was the brainchild of that remarkable man, Don Lipset, who was also a longtime director of ISI. And I think that in some sense, the Philadelphia Society was conceived as a home for ISI students who had the misfortune to become grown-ups. But Don and the other founders of the society, Richard Weaver, Frank Meyer, Gerhard Niemeyer, Father Stanley Parry, and Stan Evans among them, set down before the first meeting a mission statement that has stood the tests of time. Very briefly, the purpose of this society shall be to sponsor the interchange of ideas through discussion and writing in the interest of deepening the intellectual foundations of a free and ordered society and of broadening the understanding of its basic principles and traditions. And it goes on at a later point to say, we shall seek understanding, not conformity. Well, as we have seen this weekend, we have certainly been successful at avoiding conformity. And I think that's a good thing. The Philadelphia Society has flourished best when, as any conservative institution, it has kept faith with its founding vision. And the same is true, I think, of the movement, of our movement, the conservative movement. Reflect a moment on a fact that is sort of the elephant in the room, but we don't talk about that much, which is the movement is known as the conservative movement. That's its name. It might not have been so. ISI itself was originally the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, and one of the early flowerings, intellectual flowerings of our movement was called the New Individualist Review at University of Chicago. But we will not be known to history as the individualist movement. Similarly, traditionalism was a strong current throughout the past 50 years. Yet we are not the traditionalist movement, nor indeed are we the classical liberal movement or the libertarian movement, although those elements have from the first been pillars of what it means to be an American conservative. No, as a movement, as I say a movement, that's the level of generality is the point I'm trying to make here. As a movement, we are not Straussians or Vogelinians or Paleos or Neos, European reactionaries or American exceptionalists. We are the conservative movement. And our identity as a whole is broader, more capacious, and in a certain sense, truer than our hyphenated sub-identities. And I think that means something. I think it captures the truth about what conservatism really is. It is a historical fact that as a political movement, conservatism has been non-ideological, the American conservative revival since the late 40s, non-ideological. Nobody can contest that. That's a fact. The man who gave modern conservatism its name, its revival in America, Russell Kirk, would go further. He would say that conservatism as a philosophical matter is the negation of ideology. Or as he told me once while we were walking the hills of Scotland, it is a disposition of openness toward reality. That's what he told me. He was willing to give insights about conservatism, although not definitions, because it's non-ideological. But because conservatism is the politics of reality, it treats with general truths about human persons, human society, and the common good, truths known from experience. The Procrustean bed of ideological reductionalism and the exacting purity of litmus tests is the very opposite of the conservative disposition. In being open to the whole rambling totality of experienced reality, conservatism is open as well to new experience. There is thus a kind of aggregation, intrinsic and genuine conservatism, or dare we say it, a certain fusionism. Each tendency within the conservative movement taken on its own, may be in peril of falling into ideology, that is, mistaking partial truths for the whole truth. But taken together, conservatism captures more of the whole truth about politics and the common good. There's also a quite practical advantage to conservatism's habitual appeal to broad general truths. By proceeding in such a non-ideological way, conservatism politically, naturally, attracts to itself a wide array of men and women of goodwill who can recognize within conservatism something genuinely relevant to their own various teleological concerns. It is an apparent paradox, but it is true, that we are true believers in a conservatism that has room for far more than true believers, at least as we defined our sub-identities. In this time of often quite intense debate among conservatives, it is well to remember this. I will say George Nash is with us in his wonderful book, which has never been transcended, on the conservative intellectual movement. Libertarians, anti-communists, and traditionalists were the three tendencies he describes in the formation of the movement. I'd like to consider them for just a second. Take one as a point of departure for considering the other two strands in seriatim. From the point of view of the libertarian, traditionalists were nothing but coercive collectivists intent on legislating morality, while anti-communists, from the libertarian view, were calling America to a worldwide crusade which could only lead to the aggrandizement of state power, for was not war the health of the state? From the point of view of anti-communists, the libertarian devotion to individualism, in point of fact, hastened the appearance of mass man, for the vast majority of men were simply not equipped to flourish when freed from traditional authorities and social bonds. The disoriented mass man, in turn, becomes easy prey for the totalitarian temptation. Traditionalists, on the other hand, were thought, from the anti-communist perspective, to be parochial, inward-looking, and insufficiently alarmed at the threat of communism. They were too often given to an isolationism that would cede the globe to communist oppression. And finally, from the point of view of the traditionalists, the Cold War that the anti-communists proffered was sure to mobilize society, and a mobilized society is quite the opposite of a traditional society. And the libertarians, from the point of view of the traditionalists, seemed little more than libertine immoralists and ideologues to boot. But whenever we despair of the conservative movement on account of its intramural fractiousness, it behooves us to recall how intense were these early disputes and continuing disputes when our movement was forged. Was the conservative movement then nothing but a shotgun marriage in the face of the communist threat? Was fusionism just a word to paper over irreconcilable differences? Ben Rogie, at one of our meetings, said that the Philadelphia Society has three purposes. The traditionalists take it as a matter of faith that the Philadelphia Society has a purpose, but believe that purpose to be unknowable. The libertarians think that the Philadelphia Society may well have a purpose, but that is largely irrelevant to the ongoing workings of the market. And the fusionists believe that the Philadelphia Society has a purpose and that it does not. But as we consider the subtle and intricate connections and of these groups, and we just talked about how the suspicion with which they view each other, think about the areas of agreement. This responds to Vicky's injunction about General Bunting's comment, but here's some points of agreement, Vicky. Libertarians, their central thinker was Albert J. Knock in the post-war era, and he insisted that true liberty is something demanding, hard, and in fact is only really possible for those who've undergone an intense cultivation in high culture, who know the great books. In other words, the libertarians of this era shared something very important with the traditionalists. Moreover, the libertarians could certainly affirm that the anti-communists were exactly right, that communism represented an extreme violation of liberty of the individual and so must be resisted. For anti-communists, the libertarians were certainly correct in their fear that it can happen here. Domestic communism was indeed a genuine threat, and we might well be on the road to serfdom. What's more, for the anti-communists, the traditionalists were right in their critique of mass society, for the emergence of mass man was indeed the enabling condition of totalitarianism. The traditionalists were also right when they contended that a flourishing civil society, richly settled in tradition, was the best possible domestic defense against the totalitarian temptation. For the traditionalists, the libertarians were right that freedom was, if not the, at least a key element of the Western tradition. The free society is a Western tradition to be celebrated and defended. And the anti-communists were right that their distinction between ideological totalitarianism and traditional authority was primarily on the grounds of the communism's atheism. So the traditionists agreed with the anti-communists, but at least agreed with Whitaker Chambers on that point. This then is our history as conservatives and as members of the Philadelphia Society. It is a commitment to a common conversation among the strands of conservatism, and we have always opened ourselves to be challenged by the insights of each other. In doing so, I think we've all grown an understanding in the ways which we could not have foretold, and I think that we have accomplished together great deeds. We have faced down the bloodiest tyranny the world has ever known. We have transformed a nation's suffering from post-war lassitude into one of the most dynamic economies on earth. We have so routed the left at the level of ideas that it can no longer speak the language of socialism, but must mask its aims and euphemisms. And we have encouraged and profited from a great awakening that has burnished America's reputation as the most religious society in the advanced industrial world. There is no reason why the new disagreements we encounter today must lead to a conservative crack-up. I've always thought that these annual predictions of the conservative crack-up were somewhat overdrawn, just like the war between the sexes. The reason the war between the sexes will never really take off is there's too much fraternization with the enemy. And that's the way I feel about our intramural disputes in conservatism. And surely our work is not done. We must secure our country from the threat of Islamist terrorism. We must repulse the Bulgarian assault on the high culture. We must arrest and reverse the decline of morals. And alas, we as conservatives must relearn our own lessons about the imperative need for limited government. So my answer then to the question of where are we going is merely this. We must make that journey together as we always have.